Translation, whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. First part, the process of changing one's nature at the critical moment of death is here explained. A person who at the end of his life quits his body thinking of Krishna attains the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. But it is not true that a person who thinks of something other than Krishna attains the same transcendental state. This is the point we should note very carefully. How can one die in the proper state of mind? Maharaj Bharata, although a great personality, thought of a deer at the end of his life, and so in his next life he was transferred into the body of a deer. Although, as a deer, he remembered his past activities, he had to accept that animal body. Of course, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death. So this life creates one's next life. If in one's present life one lives in the mode of goodness and always thinks of Krishna, it is possible for one to remember Krishna at the end of one's life. That will help one be transferred to the transcendental nature of Krishna. If one is transcendentally absorbed in Krishna's service, then his next body will be transcendental, not material. Therefore, the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is the best process for successfully changing one's state of being at the end of one's life. Translation, whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. At the end of chapter 7, Arjuna was asking, what is the process of dying and leaving our body? So Krishna has dedicated that whole chapter, chapter 8, to discussing the process of leaving your body, what happens when you leave your body. So in this verse, this is probably one of the important verses of this chapter. He's telling how you determine your next body. This, of course, presupposes that we go from body to body. And that has already been discussed from the very beginning of the book. That is in chapter 2. That's the first revelation of Krishna to Arjuna. You're not the body at all, but the soul goes from body to body. So there's no such thing as death for you. There is ends of your body. Your body will die at a certain time, but you do not die. So you go from body to body. So this is Krishna's first revelation to Arjuna. So then the next question would come, then what determines what body we get into next? So this is his answer here. Chapter 8. Whatever you remember when you die, that you attain, that body you get. So we can take that very literally here, and that's the example given in the purport. Bharat Maharaj was a great king, and then he went and renounced everything, and he went off to the forest as a vanaprastha, and he did his practice. Then he attained a state of bhava, which is very elevated. It's a stage of perfection, actually. And he was able to experience ecstatic bliss and realize the Supreme Lord, actually. So he's in a very high state. Then, by some accident, we don't call it accident, by some event, he happened to save a baby deer who was abandoned by its mother, who was running away from a tiger or lion like that. And so he rescued that baby deer and no longer had a mother, so he acted like the mother and he brought that deer up and fed the deer and took care of it. The deer was very affectionate and it treated him as his mother. And he developed a very strong attraction for that deer. So much so that actually he became absorbed in the deer And he forgot about his spiritual practices, and he forgot about Vishnu. And he was thinking about the deer all the time. And then he was actually older at that time, and then when he was dying, he was thinking, now what's going to happen to that deer? If I die, then the deer will be, you know, completely helpless, and some wild animal may eat it. And he was thinking, oh, what's going to happen to the deer? And he died. And when he got his next body, it was a deer body, because he was thinking of a deer. And so it's very literal, taking the words very literally here. What you think of, you become that. Fortunately, because he was such an advanced devotee, though he was in a deer body, he still had his, let's say, his consciousness of his previous lifetime, and he understood that he made a big mistake, and he still carried a spiritual potency there in that body of the deer. Next lifetime, he became a human being again, and he advanced further in his spiritual development. But anyway, the example is given to show that the thoughts, when one is dying, have a big say in what type of body you get. And the thoughts when you're dying are more or less determined by the great attachments you have in your life. So Bharat did not have many family attachments. He gave up his palace, he gave up his family members and children, everyone. And he was in the forest, and he became very attached to the Supreme Lord. Unfortunately, he gave that up also, and he became attached to the deer. So therefore, when he was dying, that's what he thought of. He didn't think of Vishnu, he didn't think of his wife, he didn't think of his children, didn't think of his palace, but he thought of the deer. That was the last attraction he had, and that's what he thought of when he died. So in this way, the mind is in one sense rather fickle, because unexpectedly it will think of the wrong thing in the wrong time when you don't want it to. So he thought of the deer instead of thinking of Vishnu. And of course, he knew that when you die you have to think of the Supreme Lord. He knew all that theoretically, but unexpectedly he died, and then he was thinking, oh, well, what's going to happen now for this deer? Just spontaneously he thought like that because of his great attraction. Materially speaking, if we think of something material, this will is an indication of our attraction, especially when we're dying. We are under some stress because that's the end of our life. And if we're very ignorant, we don't even know what's going to happen. We may be afraid or whatever. So naturally, we can think of two things. One, we'll think of that person who can save me from death, maybe, or protect me. Or we'll think of that person that I have to protect or something, because I'm leaving now, and what's going to happen to this person now? So out of attachment, we'll think of that person, or out of attachment, we'll think somebody can protect me, perhaps, out of fear. And that was the case of Ajamil. Ajamil, when he was dying, he thought of his son. Maybe my son can protect me because these Yamadutas are coming for me. So he yelled out the name Narayan, Narayan, the name of the son, out of attachment and fear. Here, he was thinking out of attachment and concern for the deer. What's going to happen to this nice deer now that I'm going to die? So this is a common thing. We all think of those persons we're most attached to. In this case, it wasn't even a person, it was a deer in this case. In most cases, it'll be a person. In rare cases, it may be a thing like money or something like that. So if one's very attached to money more than people, then one will think of, oh, the money, what's going to happen to money now that I'm dying? Yeah? So that's more unfortunate still, probably. Anyway, most people will think of somebody when they're dying. Actually, the one person said this. He saw a lot of people die in war. So he said, you know, it's very funny, but all these young people that are dying there, they always say the same thing when they're dying. What's that? They ask for the mother, yeah. Basically. Probably they weren't married or anything like that. They didn't ask for the wife, they asked for the mother. Yeah, I'm thinking about the mother when they're dying. So a strong attachment is there, something like that. In this way, this will push us on into the next life with such attachments again. And here, of course, the intention of Krishna is that you should think of Krishna and attain Krishna. But unless you are trained like that to become attached to Krishna, you're not going to think of Krishna when you're dying. Even if theoretically, you know, that's I have to become spiritual and get out of this material world by thinking of Krishna. If you're not attached to Krishna, then you're never going to think of him when you die. You'll think of some material person who you're attached to instead. So this is a general case. Our material attachments are greater than our attachment to the Supreme Lord. And even in the case of Bharata, his material attachment was greater than his attachment to the Lord, even though he had got such great spiritual advancement. Even so, that last attachment overshadowed his attachment for Vishnu even. And that attachment was very great because he was on the stage of bhava, which is beyond sadhana even. It was beyond practice. He had realized the Lord, but still, that last contact with the deer overshadowed that, and then he thought of the deer. So therefore, material attraction is very, we say, devious and very pervasive, and it can pop up at any time. Because we're in the material world, we're associating with material objects and with other persons and other things, and the attachment can arise very quickly, unexpectedly. So what this illustrates, of course, is that your attraction and what's in your mind is a big force. Sometimes we'll think that the mind is, even if it does have some force, as we discussed the other day, it has the force to move objects to some degree, even a little bit. It can move an object like that, and by that we can understand it's real. But we may think it's very difficult to, the mind to do anything more than that. But here we see what the mind does. It does more than that. It makes your next body. And that's a very powerful influence of the mind. And actually produces your next body, your next material body. It determines your next material body. Of course, it doesn't manufacture it out of nothing or anything like that. But definitely it creates a whole other world for you with a whole other identity. And then when you get that body, then you have your own perceptions, your likes and dislikes, and you have your own view of the world. And that is determined by the mind. When you're dying, your state of mind. So, of course, the mechanics of this are maybe difficult to understand at first, but actually it's not so difficult because, as I discussed last night, actually there is subtle material elements called the mind, intelligence, and false ego, and the senses, the subtle senses. And these are the components of a subtle body. Just like we have a gross body here, we have another body just like this, but we can't see it. And it's made up of these other elements, the mind, intelligence, ego, and senses, etc. And this body is as real as this body. And it's actually more real in one sense because it determines this body also. And without this subtle body, this body actually can't really function. We all know, scientists will discuss the body and they'll see all the little, how it works and how nerves and muscles and bones and all the things are coordinated together and operating and the organs are all doing different things. Yeah, it's a very complex process, of course, and scientists try to analyze and see how it works. To some degree they understand how it works, but in one sense, if they just analyze this, they'll never really understand how it works because this is not the whole body. The subtle body is also there, and the two are connected together. And if you take the subtle body out completely, this body will not operate. So there's an intimate connection between the two bodies. So the subtle body is important because it is the vehicle for the consciousness to come from the soul to the subtle body to the gross body. It's like a medium in between the gross body and the soul, and the subtle body. And so it's very important. And it holds feelings, emotions, memories, thoughts, logic, intellectual processes, identity, ego, karma, the reactions, your stored up reactions for the future. All of these things are held in this subtle body. So this is a very, very important part of us. This is how we experience things, actually. Now, this, of course, scientists say, oh, that's not true. It's all in the brain. And, you know, some scientists have done this. There's one famous scientist, Delgado, I think his name is, behavioral scientist. After the Second World War, they began experimenting with the brain. And then they discovered that different parts of the brain were responsible for different things, you know, like seeing and all this. Moreover, they discovered that certain parts of the brain, if you stimulated them, they could induce different emotions. Say you have your anger in one section, your happiness in another section, and you know, all this like that. And it's, you know, regular in the brain. So therefore, if we just stimulate that little part, the happiness part, then you'll always be blissful. You know, smiling all the time. And you do the other part, the person will be angry all the time. And they could demonstrate that by putting electrodes in the brain and stimulating it somehow or other. Yeah? And they develop finer techniques than that by doing it at a distance without the electrodes also. So in this way, you can control your states of happiness and distress or whatever. So based on that, they say now we can control everybody. Because we get control of your brain. So that was the whole idea of behavioral sciences. You know, we just manipulate everybody and make them like we want to make them, and then that's it. However, they don't take into account that there's a subtle body there, and the thought and the subtle body is emotion, subtle memory. Now, this also has, of course, memory. You know, the little neurons doing things to create memory and whatever. So there's a little confusion there. The scientists say, no, everything's in the brain. But, you know, the Vedas say something different. They don't even mention the brain. In our analysis of the material elements, we've got the eye and the ear and the nose and the touch. Where's the brain? It's not even there. Not in the Vedic system. They don't care about the brain at all. It's not mentioned at all. No? And, of course, even the eye and ear, it's not even this eye and ear that they're talking about. It's a subtle one. And where's the brain? Instead of the brain, we got the mind, intelligence, and false ego. And that's what we're talking about, all on the subtle level. So they're not talking about the gross ones at all. That's part of the air, water, eats, fire, all this. This is part of the, you know, gross body. And so when the Vedas talk about the, you know, the senses, it means the subtle senses. And along with the subtle senses, we get the mind, intelligence, false ego. That's where the so-called brain is for us, you know, for the Vedic life. So that's where the real thinking goes on, etc. Of course, we don't deny that this brain is here and that it does something, but the real source is somewhere else, actually. And it's connected to this one. This is the gross manifestation of something. So just as the subtle eye is reflected in the gross eye. So like that, we got the gross brain, and then we got the subtle body also with the mind and emotions, etc. So the two are related, but of the two, the subtle body is more important. Because that does not die. Those senses and the mind and the intelligence of the subtle body don't die. The experiences you get and the intelligence you've developed over all your lifetimes goes with you. It doesn't end with one lifetime. Those experiences go to your next body. Some scientists, of course, they've recognized this. Some brain scientists, you know, brain surgeons. They actually realize that there's something other than the brain here. After they've done so many operations to see how people react and all the responses and all that, they realize that we cannot explain everything about the human being in terms of his brain. His thought is something else, actually. So they won't say the consciousness is in the brain or the thought is in the brain. The intelligent surgeons will say, no, there's something else. We don't know what it is, but it's not definitely... It's not just the brain working. There was It's probably a true thing. I don't know how. Anyway, someone related this. I heard this story. In the Second World War, they had the German pilots would go over and bomb, you know, Britain. And they had the pilots going over in their airplanes and then come back later on. So they would send pilots over. But of course the British were shooting at them, you know, and trying to shoot them down. So one time two German pilots were in the airplane and they went over there and the British were shooting at them like that. And then the plane actually came all the way back from Britain back to the German side and it landed in the airfield. But the surprising thing was when they landed and then the plane stopped. And then the people on the ground, they came up and they opened the cockpit. But the funny thing in the cockpit was that there was, you know, the pilots were there, whoever was in the airplane and doing the driving, but their heads were shot off. But they managed to get the airplane all the way back to the airport and land it. They didn't have any brain. The whole top of the head was shot off. Without a brain, they managed to get it back and land the plane also. So somehow, something was operating without the brain there.
So the pilot didn't die?
Well, they were dead. They had no head. Head was gone. Whole top of the head was finished. Good. The brain technically was not functioning anymore, and they weren't. They were dead. You can say dead, but somehow or other, something was going on there, moving the machine around with the body and everything, and they landed. So in other words, there is something else there also, which
was the soul then?
Probably the soul. Probably there was some. The subtle body was there, and the soul was there in a very, very, you know, tenuous state. But technically, the body was destroyed. Head was destroyed. So the illustration is there to show that there's something beyond the brain also. So that's why some brain scientists also, they understand that we cannot account for everything in the brain alone because of that. This of course is supported again by the fact of the near-death experience. Some people have physical death, clinical death. That is, their brain stops and the brain waves have stopped, etc., for some time. Now, near death means that this happens, they're near dead. Technically, they should die and the oxygen should be cut off and there's no possibility of them coming back to life. But somehow or other, unexplainably, inexplicably, they do come back to life later on. That's called near death experience, where they clinically do die and the brain stops and they stop breathing. But somehow or other, they come back to life and it cannot be explained by science. So, technically, when they're dead, then they should have no perceptual mechanism, no experience, nothing. Because they're dead. However, investigations show, this has been done like in 3 or 4 investigations have taken place on this in the last few years. The doctors have done this, you know, and they've interviewed the people afterwards and everything like that. So, they were able to confirm that these people, in the time when they were died, so in a death experience, in other words, the brain was dead, usually what happens is they have experiences. They say, well, I'm floating out of my body, and then this happened, that happened, whatever. So if they take those experiences of perception, they're perceiving something, obviously, is it true or not? So the doctors tried to confirm whether their observations at the time were actually factual. Could they confirm it in some way? So they interviewed the people in that. And from that, they were able to gather that, yes, they could give accurate testimonies of what happened. The brain dead, but if they do observe things which could be confirmed by other sources, then they would have to have perceived it. Because there's no way of them, getting that information. For instance, they could describe the operation that took place or what they did after the person had died in the operation room. How are they going to know that? No one told them. So how would they know? And if they could accurately describe certain things, then that would mean that they're perceiving something when they're dead. Or they could perceive something. One person, apparently, he
he went out of his body, and then he went out, he floated out the window. And when he looked out the window, then there was something on the ledge outside the window. And so he reported that after. And I floated out the window, and that's what I saw outside the window. So they looked out the window, and the object was there. And nobody knew it was there. So like this, they got sort of confirmations of different things when they were actually supposed to be dead. Yeah. So then they had to understand that there must be some other level of consciousness and some other mechanism there which was existing and could perceive things when the body was just lying there and the brain was dead and the senses weren't operating. In other words, there's perception and consciousness and memory all intact apart from the dead body. And that was their conclusion, that it must be so because of the, you know, different evidences they got from that. So their conclusion was there's something beyond the material body. That was their conclusion. They won't say what it is, but obviously it points in the direction of some conscious thing or mind, substance, or soul or something. At least that much. So anyway, that of course is an indication for us. It gives a good explanation, or we can explain that phenomena in terms of soul and subtle body being actually separate from this material body. They're also real, and the center of consciousness is in the soul, and is picked up by the subtle body, which can perceive all these things in, you know, in the material world, and memorize them and keep it in the mind. And then if you happen to come back to life again, then your body gets stuck on here again, and then you get the memory coming out to this, you know, gross brain again, or whatever. So this is another sort of proof that a subtle body exists, or the mind exists beyond the gross brain and the gross body. So there are several indications in modern science itself that there is a subtle body, or there is a soul beyond the material body. That's the subtle body is there. Next thing, of course, is that this whole idea of getting into the next body, which is the subject of this thing, this verse, that whatever you remember, that determines your next body. That, of course, is a little harder to prove, in one sense. But the strange thing is that the people that have these experiences that do die and then come back to life, it's very difficult to explain how they come back to life, because technically they shouldn't. Once your brain is finished, it's finished, you know, and they shouldn't come back to life. How does it happen? Generally, they're told that they have to come back. So in other words, there's some other force there determining that they're not going to die at that time, and they're going to get put back in the body again, and the body's going to come back to life, and some other force is there which pushes the body back to life again, even though it shouldn't. So they usually have this experience, they go to some other realm, and then they're told, well, you cannot die now, it's not your time to die, and you have to come back to your body now. So they make some arrangement by which you get back in your body, and your body comes back to life again, even though it shouldn't. So there's some other forces at work there. Some people do have detailed experiences out of the body. These also have been recorded by different doctors. A lot of doctors, they were skeptical, you know, of these experiences, because they look like hallucinations, or they're very fantastic, some of the stories they tell. But doctors, anyway, they, you know, they have to be objective, so they let's take all these experiences and study them and whatever. So several, you know, doctors are doing that. The first one was Dr. Kenneth Ring. He did the first study on these recollections of people that had death experiences. Then his conclusion was that they're real, real experiences. After interviewing so many people, he could find similarities in the experiences, which could not be explained if it was due to hallucination, because hallucinations are very irregular. If it was due to oxygen deprivation, if it was due to so many things that, you know, skeptics can say about how you're getting these visions or hallucinations or whatever. Apart from the fact, of course, if you're dead, you shouldn't have anything happening, then you shouldn't remember anything. Anyway, they do remember, and then they all have some pattern, some very characteristic stages they go through in this death experience. The end result of the experience is that it has a very deep impression upon them, and after they recover, they usually change their whole lifestyle around for the better, not for the worse, for the better. The doctor noted that in case of hallucinations or anesthesia or intoxications or anything, that doesn't happen. You don't change your life for the better. Make it worse. It won't get better. But you never, it never has a real positive influence upon you. It's just hallucinations or, you know, anesthesia or whatever. The experience itself has some common features to it, as I said. They go out of the body, they separate from the body, they can observe things in this world, like doctors doing things, talking, whatever, conversations, and relatives, all that, they can do that. Then, the next stage is they jump into another world. They go through this tunnel, so to speak, and they come out the other side into another world. And it's a very common experience for these people. They go through and they come out on the other side. When they get on the other side, it's a little bit various according to different religions. They they may be Christ-like figure or a Buddha-like figure if they're Buddhist, or a, you know, something they think of the figures in terms of their religion. But nevertheless, the figures are generally similar in the sense that they have bodies. Definitely they have bodies. But the bodies are, we can say, different in the sense that they're not gross like this. They say they're like made of light, or made of some very fine substance which is much better than this, much subtler, and full of bliss. And they communicate by thought, not by speaking. And immediately they see you, they can understand your thoughts. And you can understand their thoughts. So it's like you can communicate just with their thoughts without having to speak. So expression is no barrier there. Because immediately you understand the other person. And, seeing them, the good thing about that is you can understand who they are and immediately and what they are. And you can immediately understand that they're very perfect people, you know. They're full of compassion and love and all this like that. On the other hand, they can also understand that we're full of all bad things. So the people that come into that experience, they really feel ashamed when they get there, because they feel themselves so inferior because they have so many imperfections and they can't hide anything either. But on the other hand, they feel no inferiority in the sense that they're not criticized for their imperfections or anything like that. And they're accepted, but they understand that they're in a much less advanced position. Then, of course, they had observed different things in the world. One person had a very detailed experience. American, he described the whole world. Actually, he lived. He was there. He said it had. It's just like I'm like Spargo Loco or something. It was all full of, you know, crystal buildings, crystal palaces, wonderful parks, and, you know, wonderful flowers and fountains everywhere, and filled with light and rainbows and things like this. You know, it's a very fantastic place, and filled with these people who are all kind of made out of light, like that. That particular person, they spoke a long time with him. I think he was gone for about a few hours, maybe. Because he was on the operating table and they were trying to revive him, and his heart was finished. He got hit by a lightning bolt, actually, and his whole body was burned up, and they were trying to revive his heart. They were struggling for a few hours in the operating table, and they gave up. Anyway, in that time he went out, and he had some very detailed experiences of meeting these people. And these people, they're actually, they did a strange thing, and they showed him the future. They had these little boxes, and they opened the boxes. He'd look in the box, and he would see the future. They had 12 boxes. They opened up one after the other, and they showed them future events of the world, which were very bad, actually. It showed destruction and wars and things like that. Most of them were very bad. One of them was... he didn't know. He couldn't identify at that time what they were, because of the future, so he didn't know. One of them was he saw some explosion of a huge building or something like that, and a word came on like wormwood or something like that, and looked like a nuclear explosion or some sort. So later on they had that explosion in Russia, Chernobyl explosion there. So he relates to that because I think the word wormwood and Chernobyl mean the same thing or something like that. Another one he saw in the desert, people were fighting. There was a lot of fighting going on in the desert. And then a few years later, the Kuwait war broke out, like that. So he had 12 different visions also, and one by one they all came true. One after the other, they all came true a few years later. Yeah. So anyway, he had these visions. But then they told him that, you see, you have to go back now. You're not dead yet. So you have to go back. And you have a mission that you have to tell people that what really death is. It's not really death, actually. And people who are dying, who are afraid, you have to tell them, you know, what to do and how to prepare themselves. And it's not really, there's no death at all, actually. So this is your service you have to do for people like that. So now you got to go back in your body. So then he had to go back in his body, and then gradually, zoop, he went back into this world and he got stuck in this body again. And then he immediately felt all the pain and the burned body and all this stuff, and he was paralyzed. He couldn't move. And they were wheeling him off into the morgue. And then he had to do something real quick, and he tried to move his body, and he couldn't move his body. He managed to move an arm, I think, and then the nurse saw him move an arm, and then she said, "He's alive." They rushed him back into the, you know, operating table, and they did something and got his heart beating again, and then he came to life again. But it took him about a year to walk after that because he was so burned up, his body, everything like that. He had that experience, and he was so excited by that experience, in spite of the pain in his body. He was so excited by that experience that he kept trying to tell everybody about this experience, but you know, the doctors thought he was crazy and hallucinating, and his wife and thought, "What's this? He's, you know, become a Christian freak or something, you know, talking about God and all these things, you know." So after a while, he just gave up. He didn't speak to anybody anymore. He couldn't speak to anybody because they just thought he was crazy. But it was an experience which kind of completely, you know, did something to him, and he changed his whole perspective on life and everything like this. And he wanted to tell people, you know, you don't really die, you're a spirit soul, and you know, you're eternal, and there's a plan for you in your body. You know, you've been put in that body for a certain purpose, and these people know what it is, you know. And you know, if you die, then you get another body. So this is, and of course other people also have experiences like that, not so detailed as his, but generally the conclusion is that we're a soul, we're not a body. We have a purpose in this life. After this body, we'll get another body based upon our past successes and failures. We'll get another body. It's just suitable for our next level of, you know, tests or whatever like that. So this is the general experience that people do if they remember everything and they come back again. So based on this, these doctors, starting with Kenneth Ring, they said this, we cannot say it's illusory, we cannot say it's hallucination. It's real. We can't explain it, but it's real. It's just another dimension, and there's real beings out there, and the soul is doing something, it's perceiving things, and it's getting information, it's coming back, and it's affecting them in this lifetime in a very positive way. So he was the first doctor to do it. Then other people did investigations later on. More and more people did investigations on this, medical people, and then some are skeptics also. But when they, you know, interviewed the people and went through the cases, then they also accepted this. It's real. Yeah, like that. One neurosurgeon in Russia, they're all, you know, brought up an atheist environment there, so he had a near-death experience for 3 days. I think that's the longest recorded. And he died for 3 days. He was in the morgue, actually. And Then they brought him out to do the autopsy. When they did the autopsy, he screamed and he came back to life again when they started cutting him open. So, you know, he had in a car accident or something like that and died, apparently died, and then he came back to life. So after that, he gave up his medical practice and everything. He went to university, studied comparative religion, things like that. He became an Orthodox priest in the church there and everything like that because of experiences, you know. He had a religious experience also. So people change quite radically sometimes due to these experiences, I think, you know, become completely believing in soul, God, afterlife, reincarnation, all these things. I believe that. So anyway, many studies have been done on this. He also wrote a book on that, I think. But many people have done studies of this. Of course, there are always the, you know, skeptics who counter this and they say it must be because of this and this. But usually, those people that have studied in detail, they'll counter all those arguments and say it's not, they cannot be supported. You know, all the different things they give, excuses they give. So, and then, of course, in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, I think three reports came out from groups of doctors who studied these things, and they said it looks like it's true. It happens, actually. So that is like a confirmation of all these things that have are written in Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavad Gita and other Vedic literatures, that we do have a separate existence from this body, and we do go from body to body, and the events of our life seem to be planned out somehow, that the arrangement is there. We're put in a certain body for a certain purpose. Certain events are there as a test to make us react one way or the other. And after the whole thing's over, then the whole of life is judged. And then accordingly you get another body next lifetime to continue where you left off. And this is the conclusion they all come to. So the, in one sense we can say, even, you know, modern science in some sections are pointing towards the same sort of truth that is already described here in Bhagavad Gita. And so we cannot say it is just, you know, imaginary or anything like that. It's being supported now by actual, you know, investigations and whatever in the world. Another point is that supports this is that whatever you, you know, think of, you become. Ian Stevenson, he's another doctor. He's over 70 years old now. He's written several very fat books, clinically investigating things. His specialty is to investigate the, you know, the recollections of children of past lifetimes. So he has many, many cases of all around the world, and he's tried to personally investigate most of them and, you know, reject the fake cases or the questionable cases where somebody could have cheated or whatever like that. And he's only taken the cases where there was no possibility of cheating or whatever. And still, you get a lot of very, very interesting cases where there's exact recollections of the children from, you know, previous lifetime, of events, you know, hundreds of miles away, detailed accounts of family relationships and people, events of that life, of the places, etc., and descriptions, which you fit exactly. So based on that, there's no way of explaining that. How can you have a memory of something that isn't you unless you were there before? That's the easiest explanation. We have other explanations also, but are very indirect. So that's the easiest explanation, that you were somebody else and now you're somebody else, and you're carrying the memory somewhere in your brain and it's coming out. So he has many, many cases like this which support this. His only regret, he says, he was interviewed, and he says, the regret is that I did this as a scientist. Yeah? I take these cases, I study them in detail, I reject them if they're false, or there's any possibility of cheating, and I take them at their face value, and I report it to the best of my ability as a scientist, objectively. And I have all these reports here, and it looks as if it's pointing in a certain direction. But scientists don't want to accept it. They won't accept this. They won't comment on this work.
Is it Ian Stevenson?
Ian Stevenson, yeah. And so they won't accept it. Yeah, they won't comment on it. I released this book for them. They will not say a word about it. Yeah. So this is a big disappointment. I thought these were scientists. they don't want to even think about it and risk their reputation by saying something about it. But even more important than that, more interesting is the fact that he also has cases where the death experience is imprinted on the body of this lifetime, in the cases of people that had violent deaths or whatever. Like the case of one boy in India, he remembers his previous lifetime. He was shot in his previous lifetime with a shotgun. So it happened quite, not so far back, maybe 40 years ago or something. Somebody shot him with a shotgun in the test. So they investigated all these memories of another place, another village, whatever. And it turned out to be true. Relatives' names were there. The village name was exact. And even the event of his dying was there and recorded by the police. And the police had an autopsy report. And they even showed a diagram of his body with the shotgun wounds in it. But the interesting point was that when he was born, in this life, the next lifetime, they noticed on his body were these strange little marks on his chest. Yeah? And when he grew, then they remained there. They didn't go away. And those marks are in exactly the same spot as on the autopsy report, as the bullet wounds in his previous lifetime. So that impression of his death and those bullet wounds actually impacted on his subtle body. And then when he got his gross body, it impacted onto his gross body also. And he came up with those. And then he has other examples of that too. One girl was run over by a train in her previous lifetime. Her legs were cut off. I think one leg or both legs. One leg, I think, was cut off. In this lifetime, she was born. But one leg is missing. It's not there. There's nothing there where there should be a leg. Well, his last lifetime, he was shot in the head. And he died through a bullet wound, and his ear was blown off. He was born with no ear. And suddenly half the ear is hanging down here. And the top part is missing. You can't really explain it in terms of anything. It's just not there. The ear's not there. And injuries on the head. They're born with injuries on the head. In a previous lifetime, they were hit on the head or something and died that way. So he has all these cases there. Even photographs are there also. So the idea there is that the situation of their death and the pain and the violence was carried over and recorded into the body in this lifetime. So the mechanism of that, of course, is the subtle body. On the gross body, it hits you, and then it's recorded in the subtle body also. And then you take the subtle body with you, then you get a gross body again, and it impacts on the gross body. So the subtle body, or the mind, influences the gross body. Even down to the details like this. So, of course, the other thing, of course, is like here you got to remember a deer. He became a deer, exactly. So it's quite extreme. And the whole form was changed into a deer form, not just a few things on the body, but the whole body changed into a deer because of that attachment. We see that it's illustrated here factually by these examples of the wounds on the body that they end up in your next body. Not on that, of course, then you have your actual situations in life are actually planned for you according to what you had in this, from your previous body, then you get your karmas of this lifetime, etc. So in this way, the statements here are getting some nice support from modern investigations. Question.
It's not there's one website I saw where a lady doing a study on persons who get reborn into the same family.
Mm-hmm.
She's come across a lot of cases where perhaps the grandmother is born as a daughter's daughter, a child who dies and then gets reborn again into the same family,
mm-hmm.
and they. When they're a little bit older, they start talking about toys they had in their previous life, which the family has just thrown out. But they remember that. You come across a lot of case histories like that.
Obviously, because of attachments, we have such attachments, then this is very, very possible, will appear in the same family in a different relationship somehow or other, you know, that may go over a long, long period of time. Even if it's not family, they may appear in other relationships also. They may appear as a friend or as a teacher, or, you know, somebody may appear in a different relationship. And one case of another psychiatrist, he hypnotized one woman. She had psychological problems, and then she went back and she recollected about 50 lifetimes over 5,000 years from ancient Egypt all the way up until the First World War. She had all these different recollections. She was a man or a woman or whatever, you know, in different countries of the world, starting in Egypt, Greece, all these different places. And periodically she would recognize people in her present life from way back then. So in her Greece life, she had a teacher. She was a philosophy student there, and nothing particularly bad happened in that life. She was describing her life. She was a philosophy student. She studied philosophy. So when she started talking about it, she looked at the teacher, the philosophy teacher, and then she looked at it, and then she told the psychiatrist, "That's you." So he had appeared as the teacher in one lifetime. Now he was a psychiatrist in this lifetime. And he recognized, she recognized her, one person that murdered her in one lifetime, came back as her girlfriend in this lifetime, and then her father in this lifetime was somebody else in the last, you know, like this. And there may be many lifetimes before, but they'll crop up again. So often it's because of attachment is one. Another is, of course, we have karmas to pay. My karma is not just my karma, but it's all related to everybody else's karma around me, because I do something to somebody, somebody does something to me, and then if I do something to somebody, then, you know, I have to get some sort of response from them, like a karmic debt or something like that. So everybody keeps coming back and exchanging things like this. Huh? So it's very, very complex. And but it's also bondage, of course. You come back because of attachment, because of debts to pay, etc.
Right. And there was a video when I first came to Paris. It was an Australian documentary program, and they had two common Australian
animals. Oh, they were hypnotized to go back.
They do the hypnotherapy, and they looked even like they were just sort of, but then they took them back to these places where they were supposed to come from.
Yeah.
Old France, and I think old England.
England.
And the one lady I remember in France, they took her to a building and they said, well, she could have recollected this from a book.
Yeah.
But then she pointed things in the building,
like
windows and that didn't look like, and then a close examination, oh, there was a window, and this is just an old relic of a building, it wasn't a full thing. So that was just, I mean, I don't know how someone could dispute that. Really.
And she also spoke French.
Yeah.
Ancient French. Who knows? No one can speak that language now.
I just find it amazing that even after seeing things like this, people sort of still dispute, and then they say to us, we're all so dogmatic.
Yeah. Of course, they say those are rare cases too, because not every case is like that, so exact. In some cases, of course, of hypnosis, you have to watch, because
they mix everything.
Yeah, and hypnotists can actually, the subject can read his mind and say things that he wants them to say. You know, it's a very, very tricky subject, because you're all on the subtle level then, and when you're in a subtle body, then you can read the mind of the hypnotist, and if you feel he wants you to say something, you may say it that way. So that's another thing one has to be careful of. But then certain cases are kind of foolproof, in the sense that we get knowledge that nobody can think of, you know, like speaking other languages and doing all this, you can't cheat on that.
Also, wouldn't there be a degree of cheating within the mind where someone is maybe serving the king, but his memory, he was the king.
True.
Yeah. This sort of thing. Because it happens in normal life, people mix up their memories and actual experiences constantly.
So that can also be there. We can distort the experience just due to our desire or whatever. Our perceptions can be a little clouded. Just so to get accurate ones, really accurate ones, may be very rare, actually. So you get a little jumble there, just like in a dream, it's all jumbled up also.
It's all mixed.
Yeah.
There was also another thing. I was watching a show recently, and there's a famous American actor. I don't know what his actual name is. He used to play J.R. in Dallas. Very, very famous. Where is it? Larry Hagman. That's it. He was on talking with this guy, Parkinson. And apparently he had one of these near-death experiences. And again, the same thing, this is real, I've changed my way because of this.
Yeah.
And Parkinson says, oh, do you accept? He says, for sure, there's no doubt for me, I've had this experience. You know, for others there may be a doubt, but for me, I've had this full experience.
In the event of the near-death experiences, does the soul leave the body and then come back when you leave?
It possibly does. Well, I think what happens is there's a connection there still, a slight connection. Huh? A slight connection is there, but at least a subtle body completely goes, and probably the conscious, because the person is fully conscious there, the soul has to, some degree, get out there. I don't know how it works, but maybe extend themselves somehow or other like that. In astral travel, generally, they can extend their consciousness out into their subtle body and send it off somewhere, with still maintaining the consciousness of this to some degree, like sleep state, and we send their main consciousness out somewhere else. So possibly it's like that. Part of it's here, but the main conscious part is out there someplace.
Can I ask one more question? If you cut up a centipede or a caterpillar,
and they divide into two, where's how do you get two souls?
How do you explain that?
I don't know, maybe another soul gets in there at that time. I don't know how it works.
Pro, I was asking a question.
Yeah. What do you say?
It said, another soul comes.
Good, another soul can get in. That's one of their ways of reproducing, I guess, just like we have our way. And when you do reproduce, then somehow a soul's arranged to get in there at that time. So that's just a different way of reproducing that soul.
Maharaj, is the subtle body, which is a mind, intelligence, ego, different from the soul?
Yeah, it's material.
So the subtle body, which is mind, it's just material.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with the soul.
No, separate.
Because the soul identify with the subtle body, and that's why they think they're this body.
Yeah. The subtle body is like it's like this body, but it's intermediary with this body, because it's so gross. So we got a subtler body, and then we get the subtlest body of all. That's the soul. Soul is the subtlest. Then we get the subtle body. Then we get the gross. And we identify first with the subtle body, the false ego. Our identity first is there, and then to the subtle body, and then to the gross body. So if we get a gross body identity with each lifetime, but beyond that, then we have a subtle body identity, which stays with us from body to body. When we die, we still got a subtle body identity,
right?
Apart from this.
Until we come to the realization that we are not this body and not this subtle body.
Yeah, then you get liberation. You separate from both bodies.
So that's when we start our spiritual life, basically.
That talks about the pretas and the ghosts and the afterlife.
How soul is the body, how he enters this
karma, all this. Death experience. On that whole experience. Well, of course, in Bhagavatam, we also get a little bit of an explanation. There you go out of the body, and then it doesn't talk about the river and so much things like that, but hellish planets, etc. In the modern perception of some people who investigated this through astral travel, they say the hellish region is there in one sense. It's also not there in a physical sense, in a gross physical sense. You know, there's one hell for everybody, and they get stuck there. It's more of a personal hell you get stuck in. According to your, you know, psychology, whatever, you can get trapped into some sort of due to your sinful activities and your bad nature or whatever, you get trapped in some sort of subtle world, like a bad dream, so to speak, and you have to suffer there because of your activities and get kind of trapped in that psychic world or something like that. That's some people's comment on that. Not that there's actually a big place there and then somebody's there to grab you and torture you forever like that with all these other people. That's some people's observation, that's all. But this one person, he was a specialist in this. He would go out and then he'd follow different people when they died and he mapped, I think he got maybe about 10 or 15 different destinations for people according to their life and whatever like that, what type of life they had. And the worst was where they get trapped in this kind of a psychic world, which is like a hellish place. Other places is like a sleep state. And you just go into like a sleep state, like I'm dying and I'm going to sleep. And they just go to sleep and you can't wake them up in that subtle body to kind of sleep. Others live in like a ghost world. They don't think they died at all. So they're walking around like everybody else trying to live, but they're dead. But they think they're alive, you know. And you can't get them out of that illusion. That's a ghost.
So the ghost is
I think there's some movies made on like Sixth Sense and something like that, you know. They still think they're alive, but actually they're dead. So there's an actual thing people are feeling like that. Yeah? That's another state. And another is, the commonest one is that you actually go to this place, rehabilitation center, and then you get counseled and this, and they tell you about what happened in your last life and all the mistakes you made and something like that. And then they get you ready for your next body. And finally you get put in your next body. That's the fortunate one. The other one, they get caught in certain places due to their, you know, bad mind or whatever. They get stuck in certain regions, you know, like that. Okay. Hare Krishna.